From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Life with the Doors and Jim Morrison. We talk with Ray Manzarek, the Doors' former keyboard player. He'll tell us about writing and recording some of their biggest hits.
Let's swim to the moon. Let's climb through the tide.
And we'll hear from the man who recorded the Doors and dealt with the damage caused by Jim Morrison's unpredictable behavior. We talk with Jack Holtzman, the founder of Elektra Records. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First News.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Detroit School District and its teachers' union may be close to a tentative settlement that could bring the district's 172,000 students back to class soon. The striking teachers have called a news conference for this hour, saying they plan to update reporters on the contract talks. Both sides were expressing confidence today that a deal can be reached. The teachers voted a week ago not to report for work for the first day of classes on August 31st, rejecting a recommendation from their own union and defying a Michigan state law against teacher strikes. The UN Security Council is sending a mission to Jakarta to try to persuade Indonesia to restore order in East Timor. Anti-independence gangs are reported to be shooting and kidnapping hundreds of people in a campaign against the UN-sponsored referendum, which produced an overwhelming vote for independence from Indonesia. NPR's Eric Weiner has more from Jakarta.
Well, there's lots of pressure on Indonesia to restore order to East Timor. Several countries are threatening to cut off international aid if it doesn't do so immediately, and there are calls for international peacekeepers to be sent to East Timor. Indonesia is sending another 1,000 or so troops to East Timor, but frankly, many people in East Timor feel that that is the last thing they need, because it seems quite clear that the Indonesian military is, to some extent, acting in collusion with the militia, and there are many people in East Timor who actually fear the arrival of more Indonesian troops. So we're hearing more and more calls for some sort of international peacekeeping force to be sent immediately to East Timor.
NPR's Eric Weiner in Jakarta. Vice President Al Gore took to the campaign trail today, celebrating Labor Day with workers in Iowa. Joyce Russell reports from member station WOI in Ames, Iowa.
Labor support for the vice president has been cool over Clinton administration free trade policies. Speaking in Des Moines, Gore agreed future trade deals must address workers' concerns. He called himself the candidate for families under stress.
I just want you to know that I care a great deal about the working families of America. This campaign is all about bringing changes that work for working families.
Gore distinguished himself from Republican presidential hopefuls who favor a massive tax cut bill in Congress, which he says favors the rich over working people. The Gore itinerary included five Iowa towns. Rival Bill Bradley plans a two-day campaign swing through the state later this week. For NPR News, I'm Joyce Russell in Ames, Iowa.
Firefighters in California's San Bernardino Mountains say they hope to have the giant wildfire there under control by Friday. It took about 2,700 firefighters to contain the 63,000-acre blaze. This is NPR News from Washington. Texas Governor George Bush took his bid for the Republican presidential nomination to South Carolina today. Bush was asked what he thought of the NAACP's effort to organize a national tourism boycott against South Carolina in an effort to stop the state from flying the Confederate flag over its statehouse. He said people who don't live in the state should, in his words, butt out, adding that the people of South Carolina can settle the issue. The NAACP says the Confederate flag is a symbol of slavery, but supporters say it honors South Carolinians who died in the Civil War. Israel's Supreme Court has barred the state security services from using torture when interrogating detainees. Some politicians say they may try to overrule the decision. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Jerusalem.
Human rights groups have long objected to what the Shin Bet security services call moderate physical pressure. Detainees have been shaken violently, forced into contorted positions for hours at a time, deprived of sleep for days. They're almost all Palestinian. Security officials said such tactics were needed to get information quickly about imminent terrorist attacks. Yet human rights groups pointed out thousands of detainees were eventually released with no charges. Human rights groups hail today's ruling as befitting a modern democracy. Others insist that as a democracy at war, Israel can't afford the same human rights standards as other nations. The debate may continue. The High Court says Parliament can vote to override its decision. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
President Clinton has declared a federal disaster in parts of Virginia hurt by Tropical Storm Dennis. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. The Doors, one of the great psychedelic bands of the 60s. The mythology surrounding The Doors has mostly centered on its lead singer, Jim Morrison, considered one of rock's tortured poets and sex gods. But instrumentally, The Doors' distinctive sound was based on the keyboard playing of Ray Manzarek. Last summer, Manzarek joined us at the piano to show us how he came up with some of his now classic organ solos. His memoir, Light My Fire, had just been published. It's coming out in paperback next month. The memoir focuses on the years the band performed together, 1965 through 1971, the year of Jim Morrison's death.
When the music's over, when the music's over here, when the music's over, turn up the lights, turn up the lights, turn up the lights, yeah, yeah.
Ray Manzarek and Jim Morrison attended UCLA Film School together. Manzarek told Terry Gross that they didn't think of forming a band until they were both out of school.
Biblically, 40 days and 40 nights after we said our goodbyes after graduation, I'm sitting on the beach wondering what I'm going to do with myself. Who comes walking down the beach but James Douglas Morrison? Looking great, lost 30 pounds, was down about 135, 6 feet tall, Leonardo, Michelangelo's David. He had the ringlets and curly hair starting to kind of fall over his ears and gentle locks. And I thought, God, he looks just great. And I said, Jim, come on over here, man. Come on. It's Ray. Hey, come on. And he said, Ray, oh, man, good to see you. And, you know, we did, hey, buddy, hey, pal, you know, high five and all that kind of stuff that guys do. And I said, well, what have you been up to? He said, well, I decided to stay here in Los Angeles. I said, well, good, man, cool. Tell me, what's going on? And he said, well, I've been living up on Dennis Jacobs' rooftop, consuming a bit of LSD, and writing songs. And I said, whoa, writing songs. Okay, man, cool. Like, sing me a song. You know, and he said, oh, I'm kind of shy. Because I knew he was a poet. He knew I was a musician. And he said, sing me a song. So he sat down on the beach, dug his hands into the sand, and the sand started streaming out in little rivulets, and he kind of closed his eyes, and he began to sing in a Chet Baker haunted whisper kind of voice. He began to sing Moonlight Drive, and when I heard that first stanza, let's swim to the moon, let's climb through the tide, penetrate the evening that the city sleeps to hide, I thought, ooh, spooky and cool, man. I can do all kinds of stuff behind that. I could do kind of... sort of like, let's swim to the moon, you know, let's climb through the tide, penetrate the evening that the city sleeps to hide. And I thought, ooh, I can put all jazz chords and I can put some kind of bluesy stuff. I thought, yeah. And I could do my Ray Charles and my and my Muddy Waters, Otis Spann influences, and I could do just all kinds of bluesy, funky stuff behind what Jim was singing. And then he had a couple of other songs, My Eyes Have Seen You and Summer's Almost Gone, and they were just, they had beautiful melodies to them that would just allow for chord changes and improvisations. And I said, man, this is incredible. Let's get a rock and roll band together. And he said, that's exactly what I want to do. And I said, all right, man. But one thing, what do we call the band? It's got no name. We can't call it Morrison and Manzarek. I mean, or Eminem, or, you know, two guys from Venice Beach or something. He said, no, man, we're going to call it The Doors. And I said, what? That's ridiculous. The Door. Oh, wait a minute. You mean like the doors of perception, the doors in your mind? And the light bulb went on, and I said, that's it, the doors of perception. He said, no, just the doors. I said, like Aldous Huxley. He said, yeah, but we're just the doors. And that was it. We were the doors. And that's how the band got formed.
So when you and Jim Morrison decided to create a band that left the lead singer and keyboard player, you still needed other musicians.
Yep.
So you ended up finding the drummer, John Densmore, and guitarist, Robbie Krieger. But you became not only the keyboard player, but the bass player, too.
That was of necessity.
Tell us that story.
We had the four of us. I found John and Robbie in the Maharishi's meditation. And kind of an Eastern mysticism. We were into the same thing, the yoga, same kind of yoga that the Beatles were into. And that came out of the song This Is the End, comes out of that. So we were all seekers after spiritual enlightenment, and so was Jim, of course. But we didn't have a bass player, so I applied my boogie-woogie background, my rock and roll boogie-woogie, because when I discovered boogie-woogie, that was the whole thing. And you just keep that left hand going. You don't do anything with it. It just goes and goes and goes and goes. And the right hand does the improvisations. So I had done that over and over and over as a kid, so it was very easy for me to, once we found the Fender Rhodes keyboard bass, 32 notes of extra low sounding low notes, it was very easy for me to do. So that's what I did on the piano bass. Or like Riders on the Storm. And that's what I did. I just over and over, repetitive bass lines that are just like Boogie Woogie. It just keeps on going. And it becomes hypnotic. And that was that's why Lefty here is thank you. He did a very good job. He's not too quick, but he's really strong and solid and plays what he has to play. So Lefty became our bass player.
So your left hand and right hand were playing separate keyboards.
Oh, of course, yeah. One was I had a Fender Rhodes the Fender keyboard bass sitting on top of a Vox Continental organ, and the Vox Continental organ was what I played with my right hand, and the Fender keyboard bass with my left hand.
Love me one time, could not speak. Love me one time, baby. Yeah, my knees got weak. Love me two times, girl. Last week, all through the week. Love me two times, I'm gone away. Tomorrow, one kiss for today. Love me too.
We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Yeah, come on.
Back with Ray Manzarek, he's written a memoir called Light My Fire about his years as the Doors keyboard player. In your memoir, you write a little bit, you write a lot really, about how the Doors developed their sound and how you developed your sound as the keyboard player with the group. Let's take an example of one of those songs. Why don't we look at Light My Fire, which is probably the most famous or
most
one of the
famous
most famous
Doors song. Yeah, famous Doors song. You know, it's that worldwide popular appeal, most famous. And Robbie Krieger is actually the writer of Light My Fire. So the way we would work on songs is somebody would bring a song in and then everyone would go to work on it. It'd be like little bees just, or little things spinning and working and weaving. So Robbie came in with a song. He said, I got a new song called Light My Fire, the first song Robbie Krieger ever wrote. What a genius he is. He's just the greatest guy. I've got a song called Light My Fire. So he plays the song for us. And it's kind of a Sonny and Cher kind of dun, 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 light my fire. And it's like, okay, okay, good chord change. What are the chord changes there? And he shows me an A minor to an F sharp minor. And that's like, whoa, that's hip. That's cool. And that's when he went into the Sonny and Cher part. No, I'm going to do a Sonny and Cher kind of song here, man. And that was popular at the time. Densmore says, look, we got to do a Latin kind of beat here. Let's do something in kind of a Latin groove. And I'm doing this left-hand line. So John's doing ka-chinka-chinka-dunga. And we set up this Latin groove and then go into a hard rock four. And Robbie's only got a one verse. He needs a second verse. And Morrison says, okay, let me think about it for a second. And Jim comes up with the classic line, and our love becomes a funeral pyre. You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I were to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher as Robbie's. Then Jim comes, the time to hesitate is through. In other words, seize the moment, seize the spiritual LSD moment. The time to hesitate is through. No time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose. Whoa, that's kind of heavy. Try now, we can only lose, meaning the worst thing that can happen to you is death. And our love becomes a funeral pyre. Our love is consumed in the fires of agony. And it's like, God, Jim, what a great, great verse, man. So we've got verse, chorus, and then it's time for solo. So anyway, the verse goes, time to hit and do that. You know how that goes. You've heard it a million times. And then into the chorus, come on, baby, light my fire. So it's time then for some solos. We've done a verse, chorus. Now what do? We got to play some solos. We got to stretch out. Here's where John Coltrane comes in. Here's where the Doors' jazz background. John's a jazz drummer. I'm a jazz piano player. Robbie's a flamenco guitar player. And we all said, you know, we're in A minor. Let's see. What do? It ends up on an E. So how about My Favorite Things, John Coltrane. It's My Favorite Things, except Coltrane's doing it in D minor. But the left hand is exactly the same thing. It's in three. One, two, three, one, two, three. A minor, the Doors' Light My Fire is in four. We're going from A minor to B minor. So it's the same thing as that's how the solo comes about. And then we just go. So it's John Coltrane's My Favorite Things. And Coltrane's Ole Coltrane. And then That's the chord structure. Then I would solo over it. Robbie would solo over it. And at the end of our two solos, we'd go into a three against four. And I'm keeping the left hand going exactly as it goes. And that hasn't changed. That's the four. On top of it is three. Into the turnaround. And we're back at verse one and verse two. And we're back into our Latin groove. So it's basically a jazz structure. It's verse, chorus, state the theme, take a long solo, come back to stating the theme again. And that's how Light My Fire came about. The only thing left to do was to come up with that little turnaround thing. I hadn't had that yet. And we said, now, how do we start the song? Do we just jump on an A minor to an F sharp? We're going to do that, vamp a little bit? I said, no, we need something more. We can't just vamp a little bit. And I started this. I put my Bach back to work, put my Bach hat on, and came up with a circle of fifths. So I started like this. Like a Bach thing, like. So same kind of thing. Yeah. B flat, I'm in G, D, F, up to B flat. E flat, A flat, to the A, to A major, yeah, that's it. And then we'll go to the A minor. I'm thinking all this to myself. So that's how the introduction came about. F, B flat, E flat, A flat, A, and the drums and everything. Jim comes in singing, and a Latinesque. And then into hard rock. So that's how Light My Fire goes. That's the creation of Light My Fire.
And you come up with this great organ solo in the middle.
Oh, that was just luck.
Which is, of course, cut out of the single.
Right, exactly.
Because your producer figured, we got to get this on the radio.
Right.
So we got to do a singles version.
Yeah,
and it was, what, six or seven minute track?
7 minutes. We had to cut down 7 minutes to 2 minutes and under 3 minutes. 2 minutes and 45 seconds, 2:50 would be ideal.
So he calls you into the office, plays you his version,
his edited version. Paul Rothschild, a brilliant genius producer, and Bruce Botnick was our engineer. Those two guys there were six doors in the recording studio, the four musicians and Paul Rothschild and Bruce Botnick. Without them, we never would have done nearly what we did. Paul said, I'm gonna make an edit here. I'm going to do some edits. I'm going to cut Light My Fire down from 7 minutes to 2:45, 2:50. And I said, good luck, man. I don't see how you're going to do it. There's solos, Robbie's solo, my solo, all this stuff. I mean, you're going to have to do the Chinese torture of 1,000 cuts is what he was going to have to do. You actually had to cut tape in those days, no computers, so you actually cut the tape. 2 days later, Rothschild calls and said, okay, man, I got it. I said, well, you got it. How did you do it so fast? You got 1,000 cuts. And he said, no. Just come on in. I'm not going to tell you what I did, how I did it. I just want you to listen to it. So the song starts. We're all in the control room on the big speakers at Sunset Sound. The song starts with the regular introduction, and then it's into... And it's going along, and then come on, baby, light my fire, and that's going along. Now we're into the second verse. The time to hesitate is through, no time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose, our love becomes a funeral pyre. Everything's going exactly, come on, baby, light my fire. Nothing has changed, everything is exactly the same. Come on, baby, light my fire, try to set the night on fire. Now it's time for the solos. I think, where's the edit, man? And we're into the solos. I don't know where he's going to cut. This is insane. And all of a sudden, where I'm supposed to go... play my organ solo. What happens? It goes to the end of the solos. and then back into the turnaround, and there's like not a solo. There's no solos. I'm out. I've got 3 minutes of solo. Robbie's got 2.5 minutes of solo. It's all gone. It just goes da 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 and turn around. And I think, oh no, what's and then we go back into verse number 3. And then we do that exactly as the song is. And then verse number 4. It's time to hesitate, no time to wallow in the mire. Trying to be in love becomes a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. Try to set the night on fire. Try to set the night on fire. And it's the end of the song. And that's it. It's 2 minutes and 45 seconds long. And there are no solos in the entire song. And I thought, I'm going to kill this guy. I looked at Robbie, and Robbie said, you want to kill him? Let's kill him. And Paul said, hold it, hold it. Listen, I know the solos aren't there, but just think, you don't know the song. You've never heard the song. You're 17 years old. You're in Poughkeepsie. You're in Des Moines. You've never heard of the Doors. All you know is a 2 minute and 45 second song is going to come on the radio. It's called Light My Fire. Does that work? And we all looked at each other and said, you know what, man? You're right. It does. It works.
Ray Manzarek. Terry spoke with him last summer. His memoir, Light My Fire, My Life with the Doors, will be released in paperback next month. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar. If I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. The time to hesitate is through. No time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose. And our love become a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. And from Bantam Books, publishers of In Pursuit of the Proper Sinner, a modern British mystery by Elizabeth George. Available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Ray Manzarek, former keyboardist with The Doors. And we hear from Jack Holtzman, the founder of Elektra Records, which recorded The Doors.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend. The end of our elaborate plans. The end of everything that stands. The end. No safety or surprise, the end. I'll never look into your eyes again.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's get back to Terry Gross's 1998 interview with Ray Manzarek, the former keyboard player of The Doors. His memoir, Light My Fire, will be released in paperback next month. It's filled with stories about the unpredictable behavior of lead singer Jim Morrison. One of those stories is about what happened during the Light My Fire recording session. The engineer, Bruce Botnick, had brought in a television and put it in the studio. And when Morrison noticed it, he exploded. Let's hear Manzarek tell the story.
Bruce Botnick has the Dodgers on. The Dodgers are in the pennant race. Bruce Botnick's a big baseball fan. He's recording with the Doors. He brings his portable television set. He wants to see the game. It's the middle of the afternoon. Dodgers are playing, and he's got his television. He couldn't put it in the control room. There's too much electronic equipment, and it just, with the rabbit ears, these are the old days, folks. This is before cable. This is when people had rabbit ears coming off of the television set. He couldn't do it in the control room. Too much electronic equipment, too much static. He found a good place for it off to the side in the studio area, facing the window, the control room window. It wasn't in anybody's way or anything. Everything was fine. So we're in the middle of Light My Fire, and it's solo time. And I'm about to go Coltrane and do my stuff. And Jim comes out of the control room, or out of his vocal booth. You put the singer in a vocal booth. And he starts dancing around. He's having a great time. Then he comes over to the TV set, and he sees the TV set. Then he looks around and notices that it's on. Oh, God, he's... And he freaks out. It's like, what is a TV set on in the recording studio? We're making Doors music here for the first time. This is our first recording session. First time in our lives, we're in the studio. We're doing Light My Fire. And a baseball game is on the TV set. Jim picks up the TV set, unplugs the damn thing, and hurls it at the control room window. We freaked, man. Everybody just, we're in the middle of, I'm just going to town, and all of a sudden it was like, Jim, whoa, no, God, don't throw it at the thing. Hits the control room window. Thank God the control room window is double thick glass. Bounces off the control room window, falls on the floor, and shatters in 500 pieces. And that was the end of the session. And Bruce Botnick comes running out. He says, Jim, what have you done? And Jim said, what's this TV set doing here, Bruce? I was watching the baseball game. That's my TV set. And Jim said, no TV sets in the recording studio ever.
You also write in your memoir, Light My Fire, about... you know, Jim Morrison's period is like a sexual god. And you write about how, like, he'd wear his leather pants with no underwear so the contours of his manhood can be
yes.
could be seen under the leather. And I'm wondering what it was like for you to kind of be at the epicenter of this kind of like sexual adoration.
Oh, it was fabulous. It was fabulous. I mean, we made our music. That's what we did. You know, the fact that Jim attracted the little girls was something that I knew he was going to do when I saw him at 135 pounds on the beach. We're going to start a rock and roll band, and you're about the handsomest guy I've seen. I didn't say this to him. The girls are going to love this guy. And the girls did love him, of course. I mean, he was just absolutely sexual and absolutely handsome and snaky and, you know, just that kind of guy that girls like. You know, I always wanted girls to like me, but they liked him better. You know, I thought... These glasses. Maybe if I didn't have glasses on, you know, it's like the intellectual kind of. I have to wear glasses. I got bad eyes, you know.
It was funny, you know, in the first Doors publicity photo, which you reprint in the book, Jim Morrison is looking very kind of coy and flirtatious, and you're looking very opaque behind large, large probably sunglasses. Prescription
yeah,
sunglasses.
Yeah, prescription sunglasses on top of it, exactly.
One of the really big stories in the lore of the Doors. Is the concert in Miami?
Yes,
where,
it is.
Where many people say that Jim Morrison exposed himself.
And, yes, they do.
And you say he didn't exactly, but he had seen the Living Theater a few days before, and that was like the theater group was experimenting with, you know, breaking down the fourth wall and taking off their clothes in the middle of theater performances, confronting the audience, and so on. And he was influenced by that.
Yes, he was.
So,
go ahead.
So, well, what did he say? to the audience, that got the audience so excited and so expecting him.
Well, what he
to
said, I don't know if I can
himself.
Say that on the radio here.
Well,
my
we'll,
goodness.
We'll do the clean version.
Okay,
of
I'll
what
do the,
he
it's
said.
The C word. He said the C word, ladies and gentlemen. We won't go any further than that. We're in Miami. It's hot and sweaty. It's a Tennessee Williams night. It's a swamp and it's a yuck, horrible kind of place. A seaplane hangar and 14,000 people are packed in there and they're sweaty and Jim has seen the Living Theater and he's going to do his version of the Living Theater in front of, this is the first time he's been home. He was born in Melbourne, Florida. This is his, virtually his hometown, and he's going to show these Florida people what psychedelic West Coast shamanism and confrontation is all about. He takes his shirt off in the middle of the set and says, you know, you people haven't come to hear a rock and roll. He's drunk as a skunk, and he didn't tell any of us what he was going to do, if only he'd have told somebody. He said, you didn't come to hear a rock and roll band play some pretty good songs. What, you came to see something, didn't you? And they're all going, yeah. He said, what'd you come to see? You came to see something that you've never seen before, something greater than you've ever seen. What do you want? What can I do for you? And the audience is going like this, you know. I'm playing the piano right now inside the strings. That's how the audience is, just rumbling and rumbling. And he said, okay, how about if I show you my C word? And all the audience goes screaming crazy. It was like madness. And Jim takes his shirt off, holds it in front of him, reaches behind it, and starts fiddling around down there. And you wonder, what is he doing? And I'm thinking, oh, God, he's going to take it off. And the audience is getting crazier and crazier. And then Jim whips the shirt out to the side. And he says, did you see it? Did you see it? Look, I just showed it to you. Watch, I'm going to show you my C word again. I'm going to show it to you. Now keep your eyes on it, folks. And he whips it out. Oh, off to the side again. Off to the side again. Off to the side and says, I showed it to you. You saw it, didn't you? You saw it and you loved it. And you people loved seeing it. Isn't that what you wanted to see? And sure enough, it's what they wanted to see. They hallucinated. I swear the guy never did it. He never whipped it out. It was like in the West Coast, Jesus on a tortilla. It was one of those mass hallucinations. It was, I don't want to say the vision of Lourdes because only Bernadette saw that, but the other people believed and maybe other people said it was one of those kind of religious hallucinations, except it was Dionysus bringing forth, calling forth snakes.
And then you say, he said to the audience, come closer, come on down here.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Get
come on,
with
yeah,
us,
of course,
man.
Sure, come on, join us on stage. And eventually, they started coming on a rickety little stage and the entire stage collapsed, sure.
What were you thinking?
It's chaos. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's rock and roll. It's madness. It's the end of Western civilization. Dionysus has come back from 2,000, 3,000 years ago. He has called forth the snakes. The people have had a mass hallucination. They've rushed the stage trying to get their hands on Dionysus to rip and tear him apart. And I played the riot. John and Robbie left the stage, and I just played screaming, crunching organ all over the place, just the way I did when my first piano lesson, before the piano lesson, when my mom and dad said, play the piano, and I went... I did the exact same thing on the organ. I was 7 years old going, yeah, and screaming on the organ.
Was there a part of you that was saying, instead of like blah, 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 Dionysus, was there a part of you that was saying, my stupid buddy Jim Morrison is creating this madness. We'll be lucky if we get off the stage alive.
There was a part of me that was saying, we're going to get in big trouble. We're in trouble here. But you know what? It's too late to stop it. So why not treat it as a theatrical event? You know, let's create...
Write a score for it.
Let's make our own reality here. They want theater... Here's some theater you folks never thought you were going to have, but we're going to get in serious trouble. And sure enough, within a week, Jim had been arrested. He had been charged with indecent exposure, open profanity, public drunkenness, lewd and lascivious behavior, and this, they read this in court, and simulation of oral copulation. He did take his penis out and shake it. In the courtroom, the audience is going, judge going, order in the court here. And once they read that in court, I knew it was a total fiasco because he had never done it. He didn't do it.
Ray Manzarek, former keyboard player with The Doors. We'll hear more from him later in the show. Coming up, what the Doors record company thought about Jim Morrison's behavior. We talk with Elektra Records founder Jack Holtzman. This is Fresh Air. Ray Manzarek just told us some stories about Jim Morrison's destructive behavior. So how did the head of the record company feel about that? We asked Jack Holtzman, the founder of the Doors record company, Elektra Records. Terry spoke with Holtzman in 1998, after the publication of his book about Elektra called Follow the Music. Elektra started out as a folk and ethnic music label and first made its mark with such performers as Gene Ritchie, Theodore Bickel, Judy Collins, Tom Paxton, and Phil Oakes. Elektra's first big hit was the Doors single, Light My Fire. What attracted a folk and classical music fan like Jack Holtzman to the Doors? Well, one thing was their version of the Brecht Weil song, Whiskey Bar.
Well, show me the way to the next whiskey bar. Oh, don't ask why. Show me the way to the next whiskey bar. Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why. For if we don't find the next whiskey bar, I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die. I tell you, I tell you, I tell you.
Jack Holtzman about the difficulties he faced working with Jim Morrison, who was talented, commercially successful, but often out of control.
From our standpoint, the difficulties in Jim's life and the way he expressed them were nothing as compared to the magic of the recordings. It was more than Light My Fire. The first Doors album was as close to a perfect album as I've ever been involved with. That album really pushed the envelope, and I was just so thrilled to be associated with it. And if there was a price to pay, that was okay with me. I had dealt with some outrageous artists before who had problems, and artists afterwards who had problems. And I found it best to keep my distance, because I am the person who runs their record company, and I am the surrogate for the audience. And it's my job to make sure that things keep moving and that the artists are given the very best possible circumstances in which to record. And these are the issues that you have to deal with.
So you try to keep your distance in part so you could remain kind of the authority figure and not get too close with anyone.
Well, it makes it difficult if at some point you have to take a stand on something and you've been hanging out with them all the time. It erodes the special relationship that you have with them. And I think that the Doors appreciated that. I know Jim did. Before he went to Paris, he wanted to have sort of a farewell drinking session with me. Well, I'm smart enough not to have more than two with Jim Morrison, because Jim's big enemy was alcohol. And he could be a prince. You could take him anywhere, but pour a few drinks into Jim, and he would go from Dr. Jekyll to Mr. Hyde, and it was a real problem. So I would never try to match him drink for drink. But I remember this evening so vividly, because we're sitting in this bar and we've each had our second drink, and Jim begins to taunt me, "Jack, you got to go more out on the edge." And I responded, "Jim, it's great being on the edge. The trick is not to bleed." And he sort of paused for a moment, and then we talked about movies.
Your record company, Elektra, was coordinating the Doors' tours and club dates. How would you deal with it if club owners got scared by Morrison's behavior and they wanted to cancel a date?
That never really happened until after the Miami incident.
When he was accused of exposing himself on stage.
That's correct.
And then what happened?
Well, what happened then was that a decency movement began in Florida, and there was a move among concert promoters to cancel Doors' dates, and Doors' dates were being canceled all over the country, and the Doors were in a major funk over this, as well you might imagine they would be. We just kept our cool, and we kept doing what we were supposed to do, be responsible for their records and supporting the boys wherever we could.
As the head of the record company, did you ever think, oh, well, maybe I should sit down with Jim Morrison and either try to discipline him or have a little talk with him about controlling himself more?
I thought that was better left to Ray Manzarek and the other members of the group. My function is not to discipline artists. My purpose is to be the midwife to their music, to support them, to help them in what they want to do creatively. If an artist asks me for an opinion, they know they'll always get an honest one. But I didn't think it was my place to get involved in what was essentially an internal group problem. I had seen this before. I had had other artists who had problems, and I always let the groups handle them.
Now, why did you decide to sign the Doors? What appealed to you about their music?
I went to see another group called Love, who was on Elektra. And Arthur Lee, who was the essential linchpin of that group, said, stick around for the other group that's on the bottom of the bill, and I did. And I wasn't really very impressed. But there was something about the group that kept bringing me back, and was only later that I figured out what it was. It was a kind of austerity in their musical line. If I were to compare the Doors to architecture, I would say that they were the Bauhaus of 60s rock and roll. And I think that cleanliness of line and the expressive lyrics and the sheer beautiful simplicity of it is what has made the group last for over 30 years.
You were kind of unprepared for the incredible success that their first record had, and you had to call the pressing plants to get more records made very quickly because there was a big demand for them. What impact did that have on the company to have this big, sudden demand?
It was fantastic. Because suddenly, after having struggled for 17 years with folk albums and singer-songwriters that had found increasing popularity, I was now riding the tiger. And the company was catapulted into a leading position. People were bringing artists to us. We got a first crack at things. And the logistics of pressing the records was left to my brother Keith, and we had relationships with pressing plants over the country, and we were able to get everything manufactured that we needed. But the important thing was that we were able to attract other artists because we had moved up one order of magnitude, I guess, on the scale of record companies. It was heady stuff.
When you found out about Jim Morrison's death, what responsibilities did you have? Did you have to take care of his personal effects or anything like that?
No, what I had to take care of first was my own emotion. Jim had been so special to me, and the band was phenomenal. And they had played such a vital and pivotal role in the growth of Elektra. Jim had been kind to me and my family. He would remember my son Adam's birthday and bring him a musical instrument and spend time with him. So I had to deal with that. But I also realized that I had to deal with what I thought was going to be a media circus, and indeed it had been for Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin. But I was lucky. I had 2 days to prepare. I knew about it on a Monday, and it wasn't public knowledge until Wednesday evening. So I sent my number two man, Bill Harvey, out to the West Coast. We had press releases prepared. We told the staff at the appropriate time. We had to tell Paul Rothschild, who had been their producer for all of the albums except the final one, L.A. Woman. And we got all of that stuff done. So when the phone calls started coming and people wanted the radio interviews, we had determined that we were going to let the Doors do most of the talking, the Doors and Pam, and we would speak only about what their music meant to us and to their fans.
Jack Holtzman is the founder of Elektra Records. Terry spoke with him in 1998 after the publication of his book, Follow the Music. Let's listen to another track from The Doors' first album.
You know the day destroys the night. Night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah. We chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there. But can you still recall the time we cried? Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side.
Coming up, keyboardist Ray Manzarek looks back on Jim Morrison's death. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1998 interview with The Doors keyboard player Ray Manzarek.
Toward the end of The Doors' life as a band, Jim Morrison could only play like about three nights in a row, and he'd just be kind of either spent or just too depressed or manic to one or the other.
No, it wasn't too manic. The manic side, no, it was his energy was giving out.
Right.
He was depleting his energy with alcohol. And physically, on the first night he was able to do, he was fine. The second night he was halfway drinking too much. And by the third night, the booze would catch up with him. And he was just kind of hanging on to the microphone. And he had lost his chi, is what he had lost.
He told you he was having a nervous breakdown.
At one point he said, I'm having a nervous breakdown. Yeah, exactly. He said, I want to quit. I'm having a nervous breakdown. I said, you can't quit. You're not having a nervous breakdown. You're drinking too much.
When he went to Paris for what you thought would be some rest and relaxation, he ended up dying there.
Yeah.
Mysteriously.
Yes.
At the age of 27.
Yes.
What do you know about his death?
I know exactly what I said in the book. I don't really know anything about it. There's a French doctor's certificate that says his heart stopped. Whatever that means, you know, he's not breathing. This corpse is not breathing, therefore it is dead. You know, that doesn't say anything. That's insane. People that were there, people that weren't there, Marianne Faithfull was there, the Count, a known heroin addicted Euro trash European guy. Pam was having sort of a quasi affair and needle exchange with the Count. Pam, unfortunately, eventually did die of a heroin overdose. I don't know that heroin enters into the story of Jim Morrison. It enters into the life of Pamela Curson. A sealed coffin was buried. Our manager went over to see what the story about Jim Morrison being dead was all about. And he arrived in Paris and 3 days later put a sealed coffin into the ground, called me and said, we buried Jim. And I said, oh, my God, you buried him? You mean those rumors and those stories, that story about Jim being dead, that's true? He said, yeah, it wasn't a story, man. I put the coffin, and Pam was there, and two of his French friends were there, and Alain and Agnes Varda, and we buried Jim in Père Lachaise Cemetery. Well, he couldn't pronounce the name. In a French cemetery, I don't know what the name of the place is, Ray. And I said, well, how did he look? He said, I don't know. I said, what do you mean you don't know? He said, I never saw the body.
You don't believe it wasn't him, though, do you?
I don't know what I believe, you know? I believe Jim Morrison's dead. I haven't heard from him in 27 years now. But there's a lot of stories. How did he die? See, how did he die? We don't know. And quite frankly, I don't care how he died. If he's dead, he's dead. God rest his soul. However, Dionysus rises again. Dionysus is the god of rising, of resurrection, as is Osiris, the Egyptian god, as is Jesus the Christ, the god of resurrection for Christians. Jim Morrison is also going to rise again on July 6th, the year 2001. They're digging up his grave, and they're throwing him out of the cemetery. The lease is up, a 30-year lease, and they're not going to renew the lease. This is what I've heard. They're not going to renew the lease on Jim Morrison's grave, and his remains are going to have to be removed from Père Lachaise Cemetery.
Wow. Where's he going to go?
It doesn't matter. How disgusting. Terrible thought. You know, what are they going to do? They'll throw him in a pauper's grave or something, like Mozart, you know?
Are they not renewing because there's so many people who come there
exactly.
to make the pilgrimage?
It's a riot going on there. Yeah.
So did you have to reinvent yourself after Jim Morrison died and that was the end of the Doors?
No, I just had to get on to the next thing. I wasn't the same person I was before. My psychedelic and cosmic vision formed when I was 25 is the exact same one I have today. What I'm telling you today is what I would have told you 2 weeks after Jim Morrison died. I'm the exact same person. You know, once you open the doors of perception, I mean, Ray, do you still take acid? No, I don't take acid. You still get high anymore? You don't need to. Once you open the doors of perception are cleansed. They stay cleansed. They stay open, and you see life as in an infinite voyage of joy and adventure and strangeness and darkness and wildness and craziness and softness and beauty. So that's how I live my life, and I haven't changed. I didn't really have to reinvent myself. It took a long time to get over Jim's death, however. You know, that was a sad period for me.
Ray Manzarek. Terry spoke with him last summer after the publication of his memoir, Light My Fire, My Life with the Doors. The book will be out in paperback next month. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's Fresh Air was produced by Kathy Wolf. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shorrock, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Our engineers are Bob Purdick and Al Banks. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
When the music's over, yeah. When the music's over, turn out the lights. Turn out the lights, turn out the lights. Well, the music is your special friend. Dance on fire as it intends. Easy, is your only friend.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, publishers of Legacy, a biography of Moses and Walter Annenberg by Christopher Ogden, in hardcover wherever books are sold. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts, on the web at visx.com. And from Dell Publishing, publishers of Cutterskill Falls by Allegra Goodman, a novel about faith, families, and tradition, available in trade paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, singer and actor Kris Kristofferson. His latest CD features new versions of his older hits, like Me and Bobby McGee. And we meet ex-boxer and trainer Harry Kite. He's one of the fighters profiled in the new documentary, On the Ropes. Join us for the next Fresh Air.